on Monday and Tuesday as well. Some of the teachers and the staff got together and did a shared a pumpkin and carved it together. And actually one staff member said, you know, it brings so much happiness to the yogis when we bring these in. And just to see her delight in your happiness is a real act of generosity, this offering. Before I listen to a talk, I just like to remind myself that sounds are actually just waves of vibration traveling through space. That these waves of vibration can be received not only by the ears, but the body as well. And that you can just rest and receive sounds. Greg, it's okay, you don't have to turn up the lights. It's kind of nice, isn't it? I have enough light, I do. Yeah. Okay, well if you want to see me, I guess we'll just have to turn up the light. I was hoping to give this talk from underneath a blanket, but that's not going to happen. Wow. But then I can't see you. It's fine. So as I was saying before a talk, I just like to remind myself that the body can rest and receive sound, that you can listen with the entire body, and that you can even just rest and receive any thoughts or emotions, associations, images that may arise in association to the content of the talk. You can always come back to the home base of the body, just resting and receiving sound. So if that appeals to you, feel free to play with that. So earlier this year, I had the good fortune of sitting at the Forest Refuge. Before heading into Noble Silence, a dear friend of mine sent me a text. And the text read, "Have a magical retreat with your teacher. The conditions for awakening are there. Believe it's possible. The conditions for awakening are there. Believe it's possible." And this meant so much to me that I wrote the message down and just put it on my altar. And then throughout the retreat, it was there to support me through the vicissitudes of practice. So the conditions for awakening are there. What is awakening? My understanding of it so far is that it's a heart that's freed of the slight irritation to the anguish of craving and greed. It's a heart that's free of the erosive nature of aversion. And it's erosive because it can wear away at our capacity to see the good in ourselves, to see the good in other people, to see the good in the situation that we find ourselves in. And it's a heart that's free of a life-denying quality of delusion. And that the seeds of awakening are in each and every heart in this room. And the thought may have just arose, well, she doesn't know my heart. But actually I do. Because I'm in the process of getting to know my own heart. And in learning about my own heart, I'm learning about your hearts. And vice versa. We're learning about each other's hearts. Because as much as the spirit of our times would have us believe that we can't get along, that we can't respect each other because of our differences, the truth is that the differences are just slight variations on very universal themes that we all share. And one of those universal themes is that the seeds of awakening are in every human heart, no one excluded. So this practice is we're learning how to tend to those seeds. What are the conditions that result in the budding and blooming and blossoming of these wholesome qualities of the heart, these seeds of awakening? Wholesome qualities like the Brahma Viharas that we've been working with, or the 10 paramis, 10 perfections of the heart. Parami is the Pali word for perfection. And I want to just clarify what perfection means in this context. We're not talking about perfectionism, this refusal to accept anything that falls short of the standard of perfection. That's not what this is. In this context, perfection it means complete. So bringing these 10 wholesome qualities of the heart to their full maturity, their full power and strength. So these 10 perfections, these 10 qualities of the heart are generosity, embodied by this staff carving these pumpkins, aglow with light. A virtue. And virtue can sound kind of puritanical. I like to think of virtue as a heart that's just attuning to the environment that it finds itself in. So it's asking what leads to the health and well-being not only of myself, other people, all of us, but all of life. It's a heart that's just attuning to what's actually supportive, what leads to health and well-being for all of life. So we have generosity and virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve or determination, loving kindness, and last but not least, equanimity, balance of mind. So it's thought that cultivating these, when you cultivate these 10 wholesome qualities of the heart, that it takes you across the floods to the other shore. And the floods is actually a metaphor for all the ways that we create undue harm and suffering and stress and pain, not only for ourselves, but for the people that we love and strangers. And it's also a metaphor for conditioned reality. So it's acknowledging that all of our sensory experience can't yield lasting satisfaction. The lasting satisfaction that our hearts long for. And it's thought that the Buddha, over many eons, the birth and death of countless universes, innumerable lifetimes, brought these noble qualities to their full fruition, and that this was one of many conditions that led to his full awakening. Because the Buddha was a man, a human being with a human heart, that had the seeds of condition, or that had the seeds of awakening planted in his heart. That we too can cultivate these noble, wholesome qualities over many lifetimes, if you believe in that model of the universe, or within this lifetime. So I want to focus on Kanti Parami, the Parami of patience, complete patience. I think it's one of the unsung, underappreciated paramis. And it's so integral to our awakening. I feel like complete patience helps the heart to so deeply trust reality and the life that's flowing through us that there's little to eventually no reactivity to whatever's arising internally or externally. And that this parami is actually a training ground for the development of equanimity. And it supports the heart to grow into its full maturity. So there's a Theravadin commentary called the Treatise on the Paramis. In one section, it talks about some of the manifestations and the qualities of each parami. So I just want to share some of the qualities of patience. Patience is a strength for recluses and Brahmins. And when I'm reading these texts, whether they're suttas or the commentaries, I just like to insert myself in there. Because I want to feel like the Buddha and his lay disciples and his monastic disciples are speaking directly to me, not someone over my shoulder. So patience is the strength of recluses and Brahmins and of Don Scott, Daral Williams, Greg Scharf. Just put your name in there. Every heart in this room. Patience is just waiting for us to call on it, summons it up, so it can serve us as a strength. Patience is a stream of water extinguishing the fire of anger. It is a mantra for quelling poisonous speech. I love this image. Before I dive into it, I just want to make clear that the ocean at the time of this writing was a metaphor for a vast, limitless body. Kind of equivalent to our relationship to space and the universe. Vast, unknown, limitless. So patience is an ocean on account of its depth. It is a shore on account of bounding the great ocean of hatred. And as you connect with the world, there's hatred in it. But to know that patience is bigger than hatred, that it is it's vast enough and strong enough to hold and contain hatred. It can serve as a protection from our reactivity and the various ways that it manifests. So I want to talk a little bit about what patience is not, because I think there are ways that we've been acculturated to patience that isn't quite pure. What I mean by pure, it isn't fully mature. So patience is not gritting our teeth and white-knuckling it during really difficult moments and periods of challenge. It's not about waiting out some unpleasant to painful experience or about waiting out some injustice. Let's just call that what it is. It's just waiting with aversion to what's actually happening in the moment. And holding out hope for a better future. That's not what patience is. And there's a teacher who talks about the wholesome qualities in the mind as he says you can visualize them as jewels to adorn the heart and mind that shine through our behavior and our speech and our actions. So you can think of Kanti Parami, you can think of patience as a gem, a three-faceted gem. One of the first facets is gentle perseverance. To bring perseverance to our practice that's filled with gentleness. And this can help relax our internal systems of striving and connect us with a real strength of purpose or an intention that sees us through. The other facet, the second facet of patience, is forbearance. The ability to face injury and insult, that of our own or others, and by our own, we usually experience that through the inner critic. Right? So we face injury and insult without inflicting harm, without reacting. And then the third facet of Kanti Parami, complete patience, is accepting the truth, not being in contention with the three marks of existence, the fact that things are constantly shifting and changing, impermanence, that we live in a realm that is conditioned and is marked by dukkha, doesn't yield lasting satisfaction, and that ultimately we have some influence, but we're not in control. Causes and conditions coming together to create a moment, and how to live without contention with that. So tonight we're going to look at the first two facets of complete patience, gentle perseverance and forbearance. Gentle perseverance. So for many years, the attitude I was bringing to my practice was one of persistence. And on the surface, persistence and gentle perseverance, they seem quite similar. It's like persistence is just a near miss of gentle perseverance. But if you actually are mindful of these two states, you can feel into the difference and see that they're quite different in their attitude. So persistence, you might hear it as the obstinate continuance despite obstacles and difficulties. That's what our dictionaries tell us, right? And I was interested in this word obstinance. And obstinance is a stubborn refusal to change one's course of action or opinion. And in the weeks that you've been here, and the days that you've been here, and the previous retreats that you've sat, it becomes quite clear that the heart-mind-body system is constantly in flux, constantly shifting and changing. And to bring this stubborn refusal to change one's course of action does not support our practice. In the morning, you might be working with mindfulness of the breath. And then you have lunch, have some free time, maybe you have a yogi job, you come back, and you find that there's just a little tension in the system. And you try to connect with the breath, and you're connecting, but you're not able to sustain contact with the breath. It's like the mindfulness just keeps bouncing off of it. Right? So you can continue to work with that, or you can shift, you can change, depending on it's contingent on the fact that the conditions have changed. Maybe you decide to just attend to the tension, and for the first 15 minutes of the sit, just relax the body. Invite the mind and the heart to rest, easeful. Or maybe the first 15, 20 minutes of the sit, you do Satipatthana practice, and then come back to mindfulness of the breath. So we bring in this flexibility into our practice, and we let go of this stubborn refusal to change our course of action despite obstacles and difficulties. I was interested in this word despite too. And in this case, it means without being affected by. Now, this is interesting because we are always in relationship. We're in relationship with each other. We're in relationship to different states of mind. So to carry on as if we're not being impacted by obstacles and challenges when we actually are, I know for me it brings a tension into my body, brings a tension into the practice, and all the energy that would be flowing into the practice gets siphoned off into trying to ignore that this challenge is actually happening. So we can allow ourselves to have an honest encounter with some of the difficulties and challenges that arise in practice. And then we can learn to work with them skillfully and intelligently. So this stubborn refusal to change one's course of action despite the obstacles and difficulties, that's not what we're cultivating. If you see that in your practice, feel free to relax that and bring in some gentle perseverance. Gentle perseverance. The gentle speaks to the attitude that we bring to the perseverance. So there's an inner ease, relaxation, openness, spaciousness. We're actually learning to relax the inner striving. And sometimes at the beginning of a sit, I'll just recall the first few lines of a poem. It's the spontaneous Vajra song. It's the poem that Dara read to us when she was talking about refuge last week. And it just helps to prime my heart to rest and receive and to bring in this gentleness, this gentle attitude. It starts, happiness cannot be found. I say this to myself all the time. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present through open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There's nothing to do or undo. There's nothing to do, just relax, just inviting this openness, receptivity, spaciousness, just resting, receiving experience, allowing experience. What I love about what this is pointing to is happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present. So you don't have to construct happiness. Happiness arises when we let go of striving, when we let go of over-efforting, and we relax. Tranquility in the body arises. The body's tranquil. Happiness arises. Gladness of mind can arise. We can come to our practice with really deep longings and very high aspirations. And inherent in these longings can be a real nobility. There's a nobility inherent in our aspirations. So about 3 weeks ago, I was talking to a friend. She was telling me about the relationships that she's in with various relationships in her life, and she said, you know, I've just been connecting with the gold within that experience, connecting with the gold of that interpersonal connection, and I've been nurturing that and letting go of everything else no matter what. I feel like we can bring this attitude to our longings, that inherent in them is this gold. Maybe it's a profound wish for peace or safety or happiness. So we don't need to banish our longings, and we certainly don't want to banish our aspirations around practice. When we relate wisely to our longings and our aspirations, they can fuel and inspire our practice. But if we're not mindful and we forget to bring in this openness and this gentleness, the gold of our longings and our aspirations can start to fuel an over-efforting and attention. It's as if our internal system of striving starts to hijack and usurp our aspirations. and starts to use them to shame us or blame us because we're not meeting some expectation. And at worst, I feel like it, this inner striving can actually turn our aspirations into a harsh inner critic. And then our inner world becomes, it starts to feel quite untenable. And the atmosphere in the heart and mind becomes quite oppressive. And then who wants to practice? So we can learn to relax this internal system of striving by protecting our aspirations and longings, by making sure they're not being hijacked by the inner critic, and bringing in this relaxation, bringing in a relaxation, a rest, an openness to perseverance. A perseverance. It's our intention for practice, a purpose, our aspirations around practice, and it brings us steadiness that sees us through the highs and lows and the obstacles of practice. And we've already started to talk about some of those things. So last night, Dharal was talking about the five hindrances. We can experience aversion and greed and delusion or impulsivity or a lack of empathy or even ill will. And patience can actually help us to start to reframe our relationship with some of these obstacles and delays. We can start to let go of some of our ideas of what our practice is supposed to look like, or the impatience that comes when we want to experience certain mind states that were present the previous 2 days, but they're not present now. And we can actually see these obstacles and delays as a gateway and a vehicle. Actually becomes a means for helping us cultivate wholesome qualities like mindfulness and investigation and energy that then carry us along on the path of awakening. And then there's the vicissitudes of the practice, the highs and lows. And our intention for practice can keep us steady through those. In fact, the function of complete patience, and I thought this was really interesting, the function of complete patience is to help us live through the undesirable and the desirable. And at first I was like, I can see why it helps us to live through the undesirable, but the desirable too. And it helps us to move through the desirable and the undesirable without falling into our habitual patterns of reactivity. So when we experience a low or something that's undesirable in the practice, we can take it personally. We can start to fall into despair or want to give up in the face of some inner turbulence. And even when we're experiencing the highs or what's desirable, I know this happens for me sometimes, is that I can be sent sky high into states of exuberance, which is also a form of reactivity. Or sometimes when the practice is going quite well and it's going according to our liking, we can fall into a complacency. And mindfulness isn't quite as sharp. We're not quite attuned to the changing nature of our experience. And this intention can actually help us to not fall into these extremes, right? By constantly touching into the nobility of our intentions, we can steady ourselves and come back to practice, come back to balance, and discover, well, what is it that motivates me to practice? So during the teacher training, we were having a discussion about lineage. And there was a real familiar feeling that arose for me of confusion and irritation. And this feeling was associated with memories of being in a Dharma hall, practicing, coming to a choice point in my practice, and remembering everything that my teachers had talked to me and told me about practice, and then not knowing what to do, not knowing what course of action to take, and being utterly confused and frustrated. So later on during the training, one of the teachers said something to me, and he had actually said this to me about 6 months earlier, and it made an impression then. But this time, because there was this residual kind of irritation and confusion that was just present in my heart after this conversation around lineage, it really made an impression on me. And this is what he said. He said, "Touch into your deepest aspirations for practice. Choose a lineage that supports the fruition of that aspiration and wholeheartedly commit to those practices." And in that moment, like, all my anxiety just fell away. Because I knew where I was headed, what practices supported my aspirations, and that my aspirations were the ground and fuel to keep me steady no matter the vicissitudes that I'd encounter in the practice, and that however long it took was okay. And this is another gift of patience, of letting go of timelines, or timelines in regard to the practice. And when I start to get impatient around my progress, I just recall something that Andrea Feller shared with me. And then Andrea Feller learned this from Kamala Masters, and Kamala learned this from Menindraji. So from Menindraji to Kamala to Andrea's heart, from my heart to yours. Here's what they said. "When the fruit is ripe, it'll fall from the tree." It's so obvious. But we do not live and we do not practice as if this is true. So it isn't our business to constantly check every 2 seconds, what's my concentration like? And that's not to say that we shouldn't take stock every 6 months to a year just to see, get some perspective and see how are these practices actually impacting this heart? Are the paramis growing in strength? Is mindfulness arising more frequently? That's okay to do, but to constantly be checking our practice, especially during periods of long practice, that's not our realm of influence. Our realm of influence, cultivating gentle perseverance, should manifest as the steadfastness of intention, our aspiration that sees us through the highs and lows of practice and the plateaus, and that this perseverance is just imbued with an inner sense of ease, openness, spaciousness, even a creativity and a play. And it can help us to let go of our timelines and help us to reframe our relationship to these seeming obstacles and delays by seeing them as the vehicles that support the cultivation of wholesome qualities. So the second facet of patience is forbearance. And it's a protection against our own reactivity when things don't go our way. And it's self-restraint in the face of insult and injury. And this one's a really tall order, because it's hard to be the object of another's impatience, their hostility, their disdain, their insensitivity. And when we are, that there's the impulse to actually react, to meet their aggression with our aggression, to either collapse or freeze or run. And what I love about forbearance is that it's an invitation to broaden the repertoire of our responses without reacting. So complete patience as forbearance is this commitment to not cause harm, to non-harming. So when another is blaming us or shaming us or insulting us or disrespecting us, we recognize that they're suffering. And when we encounter a situation that isn't in accordance with our liking, that's really difficult or challenging, we just recognize that there's difficulty. And when someone else's reactivity and suffering is present, or when there's distress or challenge, why compound that with our own suffering and our own reactivity? I want to tell you a little bit about someone that I admire. Her name's Lorraine Hansberry. She's a writer. She's no longer with us. She's an African-American woman, born on the south side of Chicago. And she's known for writing a play called A Raisin in the Sun. She wrote a lot of things, but what she's known for is having written A Raisin in the Sun. It was produced on Broadway in 59. It won the New York Drama Critics Circle Award. And Lorraine was quite an extraordinary human. She's quite erudite. And just to give you a sense of who she was, I want to share some things with you that she said. In one of her journal entries, she wrote, "I care. I care about it all. It takes too much energy not to care." She also wrote, "One cannot live with sighted eyes and feeling heart and not know the miseries which afflict this world." So she was really sensitive to the injustices of the times that she was living in. And she was a person who was dedicated to using her considerable gifts as a writer and her very radical and radiant mind to see into the caustic and erosive nature of racism and to help deconstruct it. At the age of 34, she died of pancreatic cancer. Martin Luther King couldn't come to her funeral, but he wanted to. So he sent a message, and in the message he wrote, "Lorraine's creative ability and her profound grasp of the deep social issues confronting the world today will remain an inspiration for generations yet unborn." She has, for me, and is still an inspiration, and she's an inspiration because she didn't live with bitterness, and she had many reasons to, but she didn't. Her father purchased a home in Washington Park in Chicago, and it was a neighborhood that was restricted to whites. And the Kenwood Improvement Association issued an injunction ordering the Hansberries to vacate the home. So her father legally challenged this injunction, went all the way to the Supreme Court, Hansberry versus Lee. And during this legal battle, her father's in Washington, D.C., working with the NAACP to create a legal strategy. And then his family is left to fight this very personal battle at home. So the family is steeped in the hostility of their neighbors. And you can imagine the name-calling, the stares of hatred. In fact, Lorraine talks about a brick flying through the window, just missing her head and lodging itself in the wall behind her. And all of this was unfolding as Lorraine was 8 to 10 years old. So it's happening during really formative years. And it left a pretty indelible mark on her heart and her mind. So she was a human being who knew many hardships. She entered into an interracial marriage. At the time, she was a lesbian who couldn't fully inhabit her sexuality, her sexual orientation. And although she experienced considerable success with A Raisin in the Sun, she experienced a lot of pushback from the establishment, the theater world. And you can hear it in her interview with Mike Wallace. He's quite condescending with her, and she just responds with so much graciousness and patience in the face of his disdain. But what inspires me the most about Lorraine is that at the end of her life, she's dying. She's 34 years old. Imagine all the things she wanted to write, everything that she knew was in her, but she just didn't have time to get it down on paper. And one of her last journal entries is this: I wish to live because life has within it that which is good, that which is beautiful, and that which is love. Therefore, since I have known all these things, I have found them to be reason enough, and I wish to live. Moreover, because this is so, I wish others to live for generations and generations and generations and generations. Such generosity of spirit in that wish. There's not a trace of anger, not a trace of bitterness. And I think a lesser spirit, if they had experienced what Lorraine experienced, would have said, you know what, let America burn and just start all over again. But not Lorraine. She's wishing for others to live for generations and generations and generations and generations, because life has within it that which is good, that which is beautiful, and that which is love. So Martin Luther King was right. She had a profound grasp at the social issues of her time. She really understood the anguish and the sadness that was fueling the anger of African Americans at the time. And in a speech, she names this. She names the anger. She names the frustration and the reactivity. She said, you know, I'm tired. I want to hit somebody. And we all know that anger can be really seductive, right? It can feel good in the moment to just unleash. I feel like it's a means of discharging this intense discomfort of being the object of insult and injury. And the genius of the civil rights movement, the genius of the Black-led freedom struggle, was transmuting this primal force of anger through the practice of nonviolence and the ability to suffer without retaliation and without reactivity. Well, nonviolent action is forbearance. It is an embodiment of complete patience. So I want to talk about, I'll read you a quote first. It's from Martin Luther King. I know we've been hearing a lot of quotes from Martin Luther King these days, but there's a reason why. Due to my involvement in the struggles for freedom of my people, I have known very few days in the last few years of quiet. I've been imprisoned in Alabama and Georgia jails 12 times. My home has been bombed twice. A day seldom passes that my family and I are not the recipients of threats of death. So in a real sense, I've been battered by the storms of persecution. And I must admit that at times I have felt that I could no longer bear such a heavy burden and have been tempted to retreat to a more quiet and serene life. My personal trials have taught me the value of unmerited suffering. As my sufferings mounted, I soon realized that there were two ways in which I could respond to my situation: either to react with bitterness or seek to transform the suffering into a creative force. I decided to follow the latter course. Recognizing the necessity for suffering, I've tried to make of it a virtue. If only to save myself from bitterness, I have attempted to see my personal ordeals as an opportunity to transfigure myself and heal the people involved in the tragic situation which now obtains. So I want to talk a little bit about a campaign from the civil rights era that is an example of this creative response. It's April of 63, and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference starts a campaign in Birmingham, Alabama, to desegregate the downtown area. And it wasn't gaining much communal support, and there was a reason for that, right? The violence against Black activists at that time was quite lethal, and as an adult, if you participated in the protest, you risked losing your job and facing other dire consequences. So the Southern Christian leadership gets together and they decide that they need to change tactics. So they invite James Bevel to come and just help them think this through. Now, what can they do? And he says, you need to train the children in nonviolent action and fill up every jail until we get the attention and the conscience of America. So it's May 2nd, 1963, it's D-Day. All the parents of these Black children are so scared. And they tell their children, don't go to that church. You bet not go down to that church. But they do. They come in droves, they come in waves to the 16th Street Baptist Church. 600 children arrested on that first day. It's estimated that 10,000 children participated in these protests. 10,000 children arrested. And I don't want to romanticize the protests. We've all seen, maybe not all of us, some of the iconic imagery, the footage, the photos from this period. The fire hoses, the dogs, the men empowered to use lethal force, which they did use. These children endured these hardships, and they were able to do it because they knew that there was a rightness to what they were doing. And there was this hope that the country would see the rightness of what they were doing and respond with generosity and support. And this nobility of their purpose, it shored them up during the difficult times. They sang together. They danced. And it worked. They desegregated downtown Birmingham, Alabama. Lunch counters were integrated. And they actually started the process of desegregating the schools that fall. So there were six principles in which this nonviolent campaign was rooted. And principle three is really connected to forbearance, patience as forbearance. I'm not crazy about the language, but I just want you to hear this principle. Principle three, attack forces of evil, not persons doing evil. The nonviolent approach helps one analyze the fundamental conditions, policies, and practices of the conflict rather than reacting to one's opponent or their personalities. So when we call on forbearance and we call on patience in the face of really challenging situations, especially when we're the object of insult and injury, all that energy that was bound up in the reactivity is released and it's free to respond creatively. And that energy is used to deconstruct the conditions of the injustice. And in this case, they escalated the situation by dramatizing the injustice so that the status quo was just no longer tenable for those in the dominant culture, right? But it's escalated and the situation is dramatized with the intention of de-escalating the situation so that you can enter into negotiation with each other and start to come back into a relationship of equity and respect. Come back into a right relationship with each other so that you can start to plant the seeds of beloved community. And this is the genius of the Black freedom struggle, or this is the genius of the Black-led freedom struggle. This is the fruit, this is what's possible when we summon forbearance in the face of insult and injury. All that energy that was bound up in the reactivity is actually freed up to respond creatively from our deepest values. So what does this mean for us as practitioners? The children of Birmingham trained in forbearance. Diane Nash and John Lewis trained in forbearance. The Buddha trained in forbearance, and we can train in forbearance. So some ways that we can train in this. There are two preliminary steps, and then when we find that we've that there's some reactivity in the heart due to some situation, whether it's internal or external, there are some practices that we can actually use to unhook ourselves from that reactivity. And these suggestions, there are four suggestions from Ajahn Suchito that he makes in his book on Parami. And then I throw in some suggestions as well. The two preliminary steps is cultivating mindfulness, which we've all been doing here, right? And that this mindfulness is embodied. It's as if the whole body could be suffused with mindfulness. And that this continuity of mindfulness is filled, and I'm going to give you an acronym, SAP, S-A-P. This continuity of mindfulness is imbued with SAP. So S stands for soft. It's receptive, open, spacious, relaxed. The A of SAP stands for awake. It's attentive, it's nimble, it's attuned and alive, adjusting to the conditions that we find ourselves in. And the P of SAP stands for presence. We're bringing this receptive attention and awareness and this aliveness to the present moment. So we cultivate mindfulness. And then when mindfulness is present, we're aware if reactivity is there or if it's absent. And when it's absent, we really want to savor and feel what that's like in the heart and the mind and the body. Really get to know and start to develop a taste for what the heart-mind-body system feel like when reactivity is absent. When there's some measure of freedom in the heart and mind. And this serves as a foundation for helping us to let go when there's reactivity. Because we know how good it feels when there's some measure of freedom, some measure of stability and mindfulness in the mind, right? Mindfulness in the heart and the body. And then we're present with the reactivity, and the system of its own volition will let go of the reactivity. It's a real moment of grace. It's not something you need to will. And it's predicated on bringing mindfulness to when reactivity is absent, and really getting to know and really getting to starting to value what it feels like when the heart and mind are free of reactivity. So when reactivity comes, we have mindfulness there to let us know, okay, here's reactivity. And Ajahn Suchito suggests that we draw a line around the suffering. And this is calling on patience, right? We make a commitment not to react and not to allow the reactivity to breach the boundaries of our heart so that it floods into our speech and our actions. We just draw a circle around that suffering, that reactivity. And then he suggests that we recall that we can be free from this challenge. We can be free from this reactivity. It's the third noble truth. You just claim it in that moment, like it is possible for me to be free. And then you start that process with investigation. So what does it feel like in the body? What are the attendant emotions? And noticing the thoughts. You don't actually have to pursue the thoughts. They can be quite sticky. There's a strong gravitational pull to them. We stay with the body, noticing the attendant emotions with mindfulness. And then we start to look at what are the conditions that led to the reactivity? Where was my attention? Oh yeah, like the mindfulness wasn't all that strong in it. Started thinking about that situation with my family. Oh yeah, yeah, I can see how this started to come on in. And you can start to check out your energy level. Was the energy level low? Was it high? And when we start to look at the conditionality of our reactivity, we see that we don't need to take it personally, that it's just the causes and conditions coming together to create the reactivity. So we take responsibility for it by drawing a line around the suffering, by recollecting that we can be free from it and starting to investigate it, but we don't need to identify with the reactivity. So in this process, we're just gathering information. And the last, one of his last steps, he suggests that we draw out the hook, right? So life's moving through us, it's just moving through, and then something happens and we get hooked, and then we draw out the hook so that we can come right back into balance instead of being dragged along by our reactivity. So some ways of drawing out the hook, right? What are the conditions that can lead out of the reactivity? Sometimes it's just being mindful. Mindfulness is like magic. You just bring mindfulness to it and you can see the reactivity start to abate right before your eyes. It starts to diminish. It's magical. Sometimes we just invite in the Brahma Viharas. Can we meet the reactivity? Oh yeah. Just calling in compassion, some tenderness. Get practice taking in the good, opening up to the beauty of the fall, the sky, and letting your system just really take this in. Can help to just draw out the hook. And then with all that energy that's released, we can start to respond creatively from what we value once the hook has been pulled out. So complete patience helps to steady the heart during the inevitable difficulties that we experience, not only in our practice lives, but in our daily lives as well. So I just want to read a passage from Ajahn Suchito on patience, just to close our time together. I had to develop patience. Patience with having to explain things repeatedly. Patience with what my mind could do, noticing my porridge go cold as Ajahn Sumedho gave daily instructions at breakfast time. Patience with these inner struggles. You can't complain, said the voice of resolution in my mind. So instead, I had to watch the irritation. Just putting up with it didn't really take me across. I could put up with things and become a patronizing old grump who puts up with things. But instead, as the practice of patience deepened, it took me to the point in the mind where I could feel the chafing, the tension, the disappointment, and the wanting to get away from it. And at that point, where there was no excuse and no alternative, there was also no condemnation. After all, no one likes suffering. And we're all in this together, wanting peace and harmony, but disappointing and irritating each other nonetheless. He puts this in quotes. It shouldn't be this way. There shouldn't be any suffering, end quote. But then, isn't understanding and letting go of suffering what it's all about? What else are we here for? So let's just sit for a moment. May we call on the paramis of the heart, the parami of complete patience, to keep us steady through the vicissitudes of practice, to protect our own hearts and the hearts of others from reactivity. May we practice for our benefit and for the benefit of all beings everywhere without exception.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.